Well, I call your attention this evening to several passages. You say, I don't have that in my Bible. Yeah, you do. All right? We're just going to have to identify them. The reason that we're going to go to several passages is because we have what is called the Synoptic Gospels. Now, for years, I didn't know what that was. I don't know why I didn't know what it was, but I didn't know what that was. Basically, a synoptic comes from the word that we use, synonym. So it means something similar. In other words, it's another word that may mean like the same or closer to the same thing. Well, a synoptic gospel is when you have three of the gospels that they share a story that is very similar. Sometimes they will have details that will be a little bit different. But the synoptic gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's easy to remember. Just remember the first three gospels. Those are the synoptics. So tonight, the first thing I want us to do is we're going to ultimately land in Luke 5. But I want us to go to Matthew 9 first. Matthew chapter 9. And we're going to look at verse 9 through 17. And I think, yeah, I'm going to read it from the screen, and you can read it from the screen or you can read it from your Bible, but I'm just not going to flip through, so I'm just going to read it from here. And Jesus passed forth from hence, and he saw a man named Matthew. Should remember this, Matthew has got another name. But here, the writer of this gospel identifies this man by his own name. So he's telling the story. Man knows what his name is. And what was he doing? He was sitting at the receipt of custom. That is a tax booth. So you have Matthew that is collecting taxes. And he, Jesus, saith unto him, follow me. And he arose and followed him. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat or sat down to eat in the house there is important because it's Matthew's house. So he is sat at meat in the house, and behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. That's Jesus's disciples. So you have sitting at the table or tables, you have publicans, tax collectors, you have sinners. One of the passages that we will read will use the word others, and the Greek word for others means others of the same sort or of the same kind. And so you've got these men that are sitting with the 12 that are called disciples. Now, soon their name is going to be changed from a learner to a sent one, hence the name apostle. But right now, they have not been named apostles. They're just simply named disciples. And so it says, and when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, they that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Then came to him the disciples of John. The John there is John the Baptist. Saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast oft? Now, I thought that was kind of interesting when I was reading all of these passages. I thought it was kind of interesting that as much as John the Baptist didn't care for Phariseeism, because he was what is called an ascetic. He was a guy that lived in the wilderness. He was a guy that would be more in tune with what we would call the Essenes. But here, the disciples of John, they are connecting themselves by fasting with the Pharisees, someone that John didn't particularly care for. But thy disciples, the 12, fast not. And Jesus said unto them, can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast. No man putteth a piece of new cloth unto an old garment, for that which is put in it to fill it up, taketh from the garment, and is rent, and the rent is made worse. Neither do men put new wine in old bottles, else the bottles break, the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish, but they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. Now I want you to go to Mark chapter 2, and I want you to look with me at verse 18, and we will go through verse 22. The Gospel of Mark chapter 2, verse 18. And the disciples of John, again the Baptist, and of the Pharisees used to fast. In other words, that was something that they continually did. It was a habit of theirs. And they come and say unto him, why do the disciples of John and of the Pharisees fast, but thy disciples fast not? And Jesus said unto them, can the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then shall they fast in those days. No man also seweth a piece of new cloth on an old garment, else the new piece that filleth up taketh away from the old, and the rent is made worse. And no man putteth new wine in old bottles, else the new wine doth burst the bottles, and the wine is spilled, and the bottles will be marred, but the new wine must be put in new bottles. Now, the new is very important there. We'll come back to that later in the lesson tonight. Then I want you to go to the Gospel of Luke, beginning in verse 27. We'll not read all of these, but we're actually going to cover through down through verse 39 in our message tonight. So we'll just kind of read the first couple of verses. And after these things, he went forth, saw a publican named Levi. The first gospel that we read, what was the name? It was Matthew. So Levi and Matthew are the same person. Keep that in mind. You say, why would he change his name? Well, I can only speculate. Why was the Apostle Paul, why was his name changed to Paul from Saul? It was to maybe give them a new start, maybe to try to let people accept them, because if they knew that he was the Levi that was a tax collector, immediately the Jewish people to whom Matthew was writing would have just tuned him out. And so you have Levi sitting at the receipt of custom, again the tax office, and he said unto him, follow me. And he left all and rose up and followed him. Now, when I read about Matthew, sometimes we call him Levi, when I read about that man, he's doing something. And so the first thing that we see tonight, if you're keeping notes, is what I call the place. Where is the place that this is happening? Well, if we look at chapter 5 and we keep looking here, it'll say that Levi in verse 29, that he made him, Jesus, a great feast in his, Matthew, Levi, his own house. So in other words, there was him opening up his home for Jesus to come in. Now, Ivor Powell says that he thinks that there are three reasons for this. I would concur with this. Ivor doesn't need my concurrence, but I would concur with this. Number one, I think that he wanted to have Jesus in his home because it was the presence of Christ. I think that that we as Christians, it ought to be a big deal for us to make sure that Christ is in our home. That is part of the Old Testament, the Shema, where it talked about that you would write the scriptures on your doorpost. And you would talk about the scriptures when your kids went to bed. And you would talk about the scriptures when the kids rose. And when you were sitting around the table, you were always talking about the Word of God. And we have that in our homes today. I know that that Debbie's got all kind of Bible verses that are scattered throughout our house. And so you've probably got the same thing. Well, here you've got Matthew. He is newly converted. I mean, he is sitting there, and when Jesus comes by, the way that it reads is that Matthew basically just gazed at him. He could not take his eyes off of him. And as he is gazing there, Jesus looks at him and says, "Follow me." He gets up. He leaves his tax collecting table. Don't have any idea what he did with the money, but I just know that he got up and he followed the Lord. And that has made all the difference in Matthew's life. And so now he wants the presence of Christ. That is one of the three great desires that he has. There's a second great desire that he has, because he is so appreciative of what Jesus has now done for him that he wants to honor Christ. I can think of a tremendous example in the Old Testament where someone just loved God so much that they wanted to do something that was big. Do you remember the story of David? And he wanted to honor the Lord. He wanted to just buy a piece of property. He wanted to have the house of the Lord built on that piece of property. And when he told the owner of the property what he wanted to do with it, the man goes, "Let me just give it to you." And David goes, "Not a chance." This is the Tommy version. "Not a chance. I will not offer something to God that did not cost me something." And so he wanted to make sure that he was honoring the Lord personally. You know, sometimes we have people and they honor the Lord with their lips, but they don't honor the Lord with their works. That reminds me of people sometimes that are politicians. They're really good about giving out cookies and doling out money, but it's never theirs. It's always the taxpayers. That's not honorable. I think that if you're going to be generous with your stuff, not somebody else's. You know, I think that, you know, if me and Brother Ron, if we see somebody that's in need, I don't go, "Well, you know, I think we ought to do something. Let me have your wallet." I don't think that we get to do that. But here he is. Jesus has done something for him, and he wants to honor him. So what does he do? He has a huge meal. Now, let me tell you something. These guys in the tax collecting business, these were Jewish men. But they would bid on those positions, and they would offer certain amounts of money so they could get that position, because anything above what Rome told them to collect, they could keep. You have these men that were in those positions, and they became wealthy men. Matthew was wealthy. He's got a large house. Zacchaeus, even though he was a wee little man, he had a big bank account. He went into Zacchaeus's house. And so you've got Matthew, and he wants to honor the Lord. And so he puts on this huge, massive feast. But there's a third thing that we see that was a great desire of his. He wanted to make sure that his friends could meet Christ. Look again at verse 29. And it says that there was the great feast in his own house, and there was a great company of publicans. In other words, there was a network of tax collectors and of others. I told you a second ago that the word others there is the Greek word that means others of the same type. In other words, they were sinners. These guys were not big into the Levitical law. They weren't big into what they would call righteous living. They were about the Benjamins. That's what they were about. And so you've got these men that are buddies with Matthew, and he wants them to meet the same Jesus that he has now met. Can I tell you that is the true mark of a believer? When I trusted Christ, I wanted everybody to trust Christ. My parents were already saved, but when I got saved, I told them immediately when church was over. The Sunday morning that I got saved, it was before Sunday school, and there was probably, I guess, 150 or 200 teenagers that were in this room. And I got saved before Sunday school, and the youth pastor named Ray Turner, he said, "Well, why don't you just tell everybody?" So I stood up in front of that youth group the day I got saved, and I just wanted all of them to be saved. If they didn't know Christ, I wanted them to know Christ. Because it was such a wonderful, wonderful event that took place in my life. And so I had the desire to see friends saved. I began to witness to people in my neighborhood. I would go street preaching sometimes on downtown Broughton Street. And there would be times that I would look and I would see people that I'd gone to junior high with. And then 1 year of high school with. And I would see them and they would see me and I'd be out there holding my Bible up and giving out tracts. And they would go, "There's Tommy, he's a nut now." You say, "How do you know they said that?" Because they crossed the street, they jaywalked so they didn't have to come by me. But you know what? I wanted them to be saved. And that was Matthew's desire. He had a desire for the presence of the Lord, he had a desire to honor the Lord, and he had a desire for other people to be saved. Now, when we see that place where they were at, there's a problem that pops up. That's the second thing. There's a problem. You say, what is that? It's the word fasting. Now, fasting is very, very prevalent in Israel, especially in Judaism. Did you know, well, let me just ask you this. Maybe you do know it. How many times was fasting commanded in the Old Testament? Somebody want to be brave and say a number? One. One time was it commanded, and that had to do with the Day of Atonement, which is, we call it Yom Kippur. That is the only time that that is commanded. It's in Leviticus 16. There is never a time in the New Testament that it is commanded. Now, we often see it practiced. But there's a difference between somebody doing it and it being commanded on multiple occasions. I've got a book in my library by J. Harold Smith. J. Harold Smith came to our church in Stone Mountain, and on that Sunday morning, I think there were like 35 people that got saved. He preached the message called God's Three Deadlines. Well, other than God's three deadlines, the only thing I can tell you that J. Harold Smith ever did was write a book on fasting. I've got that book. It's a good book, but it was not nearly as captivating as that sermon was. And so we hear a lot about fasting. We read about fasting, but it's only commanded one time in the Bible, and that's in Leviticus 16. Now, sometimes people fast for good reasons, sometimes they fast for bad reasons. And I'm not telling you if you want to fast, go for it. There's a lot of people that do what they call intermittent fasting today to try to lose weight. I never have done that. I've adopted this plan that I'm doing what a fellow named Mark Hayes did. Mark years ago was a big guy like me. And he told me, he said, "I've tried everything in the world to lose weight." And he said, "I finally just told the Lord, Lord, I give up. If you're not going to help me, I'm just going to die fat. And so he told me, he said, you know what? He said, it got to the point where I just didn't have the appetite that I used to have. Now, he did die early. I don't know if the damage had already been done or what, and I had his funeral. But I thought, you know what? I'm just going to adopt that. I'm just going to, you know, try to eat right. But I'm going to pray about it and say, Lord, help me out with this. You know, and from my top end weight, I'm down about 60. Still got another 40 to go. But me and Jesus are working on it. And so you've got this fasting issue that was going on. Did you know that even Ahab fast? Old wicked Ahab in 1 Kings, the story is this, that the prophet Elijah is telling him that your family, your lineage is going to be cut off. Jezebel is going to die. The dogs are going to eat her and drink her blood. Your family, anybody that's within the city limits, the dogs are going to eat. And anybody that's outside of the city limits, the birds are going to eat. And when Ahab hears that, he immediately rips his clothes and begins fasting. He's trying to be like a Franciscan monk. And so you've got the fasting that is practiced often. Usually it's two times a week. You remember in Luke 18, I think it is, where it talked about the Pharisee and the sinner that would not even look up to heaven. And what does the Pharisee say? I thank God that I'm not like this sinner. I thank God that I fast twice a week. That I pay a tithe on everything that I get. I mean, Lord, I even pay a tithe down to the little bottle of cumin, little bottle of thyme, little bottle of rosemary. I pay a tithe even on that. If there's 10 ounces, I give the temple one. And I mean, he is so proud of his own self-righteousness. And then you got the other guy, and he won't even look up to God. He just said, have mercy to me, on me, a sinner. And so you've got him fasting. And so what do they do? Well, what did Jesus say these men did? He said that they are like whited sepulchers. Said that they rub things on their face like ashes. Their clothes are in disarray. So that they look and people go, oh, look at him. Isn't he so pious? Isn't he the pious one? And so now you've got two groups. One group that seems to be a solid group, which are the disciples of John. Then you've got the hypocritical group, the Pharisees. And now they are tag teaming the Lord. And so what does Jesus do? Well, he answers them with a parable. There's actually three parts to this parable. And we find that beginning in verse 34. So they have complained to him and they said, well, let me just interject this before we get to the parables. The they there, who is that? Well, if you read all three of the synoptics, it seems as though that maybe the disciples of John were the first ones to come because they did not understand Jesus and his disciples not fasting. And when the Pharisees heard those disciples ask that question, they go, yeah, that's right. That's a good question. Answer that question. That seems to be the attitude that both groups have had. But from the way that I read it, it seems as though that the disciples of John are the ones that instituted the question or insinuated that the disciples and Jesus were doing something wrong. Because you see, Jesus had not commanded his disciples to fast. And so now you've got people that are fasting. Well, why don't you do things like we do? Well, you know, everybody doesn't have to do things like I do. Everybody doesn't have to do things like you do. But I don't have to do something like everybody else does either. I simply understand this, that every tub sits on its own bottom. I'm not going to have to answer for what another preacher does at his church. I got all I can answer for right here. And you and I, we need to understand that these disciples, and by the way, the disciples of John, they weren't all on board necessarily with Jesus. It kind of reminds me of the Corinthians. Well, we're of Paul. I'm of Apollos. I'm of Cephas. Where that everybody's got their own, you know, favorites. Well, they had followed John. He had baptized them in Jordan. And they were all in on that. And what was their baptism about? What was their fasting about? They were doing their best to try to live a sober life, an ascetic life, so that they would make sure that people knew that they were trying to be serious and not basically be too happy. More on that in a moment. So it could be that the they there begins with the disciples of John and not with the Pharisees. Now, number three, the parables. Three parables in this one story. The first one I want you to see is in verse 34. That's the bridegroom and his friends. And Jesus said unto them, can you make the children of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them? So the picture is this, there is a wedding. Now how many times do dedicated Pharisees, dedicated disciples of John, how often are they fasting? Mondays and Thursdays, 2 days a week. But they get a bye if there's a wedding. Because a wedding in Judaism could last 7 days. And so they would have a get out of jail free card if they were the guest of the bridegroom. Why is that? Well, in those Jewish weddings, it is different than our weddings. When you got married, this is probably what took place. You walked down the aisle, you said your vows, you went downstairs and ate some cake, you changed clothes, you got in a car, and you're gone for a week. That's what most honeymoons are like, all right? That's not the way it is in the Middle East. In Eastern cultures, Judaism included, weddings may last up to a week. The bride and the bridegroom, they have their time together, but they don't go off anywhere. They don't go to Panama City, all right? What they do is they go to their tent. There are people outside of the tent that are having a great time. They consummate. But the next morning, the groom comes out, big smile on his face. His buddies are congratulating him. They're having a great time. And so you've got the groom and his buddies, and they're partying all day. And the bride and her girls are partying all day. And then in the evening, after probably the sun's gone down for 2 or 3 hours, they go back to their tents. The next morning, it starts again. And for almost a week, that's what goes on. Nobody's gone to Florida. Nobody's gone to the mountains. Everybody's just all together. I heard something that I'm thinking, if this would have happened to me, I'd have been ready to kill somebody. But there was some guys that I went to school with, and one of their buddies got married right out of high school, and three of those guys kidnapped him and held him so that he could not be with his wife that night. And all I'm thinking is, somebody needs to be shot. That's what I heard. And so finally, they let him go. And I mean, she had been bawling and crying and all of that. And I'm thinking, you know, that's a prank that's gone too far. But you didn't have that in those ancient times. But there was a lot of festivity. I mean, a lot of it. Sometimes you have people and they go, well, in the Lord's work, you've got to be serious. He just jokes too much. One of the church preachers that was, when I say church, I'm talking about the members of our church, their favorite preachers for many, many years was a dear friend of mine named David McCoy. David could have been on Hee Haw. He was hilarious. And I remember we had a sweet senior lady, and she said this about Curtis Hudson, and I heard other ones say it about David. He jokes too much in the pulpit. He needs to quit that joke telling, and needs to quit all that laughing and hooping and hollering, and he needs to quit that, and he just needs to get to preaching. Well, I've thought about that over the years, and I'm kind of the Billy Kelly camp now. You better get your joy while you can, because you don't ever know when you won't have it anymore. And he said, I've spent too much time in a hospital, in funeral homes, and in cemeteries to not take my joy when I can get it. And I thought, that's pretty good. If you read Galatians chapter 5, you read what is called the fruits of the Spirit. Now, the greatest of these is joy, according to 1 Corinthians 13. But you know what number 2 on that list is? It's joy. It is joy. Martin Luther used to say this. He said that a Christian should and must be a cheerful person. If he isn't, the devil is tempting him. You ought to be happy. You ought to be like Matthew. What can I do to honor the Lord? I want the Lord in my life. I got friends that need the Lord. What can I do? That ought to be the attitude that we have. And so, when you have the bridegroom, nobody's going to be fasting at a wedding reception. A few weeks ago, I saw Kevin come in. His oldest daughter, Allie, got married. And we went to the reception. You know, I don't think there was a single person that was fasting at that place. I mean, they had food. They had cookies. They had little old cakes. You say, how do you know? Because I ate some. I mean, I couldn't fast at a reception. I mean, I didn't want to be a Pharisee or didn't want to be a disciple of John the Baptist. I wanted to enjoy the festivity. And so I enjoyed the meal and I enjoyed the fellowship. And my table, we laughed and talked about various things. And I spoke to other people and it was just a great time. And so weddings are a joyous time. And so Jesus is saying to them, when you go to a wedding, don't you have a good time? Well, there's a second thing that he says to them, and this is found in verse 36. In verse 36, he says, and he spake also a parable unto them, no man putteth a piece of new garment upon an old. In other words, you think about this, you have an old piece of cloth. And now take that cloth, and now instead of it just being a tablecloth, think of a shirt. Think of a pair of pants. Think of a suit. I've got some suits that I really, really like. I've got a black suit that's really kind of a dark charcoal suit, and I love that thing. I have had the lining replaced in it because the original lining, it had rips where that basically the lining had dry rotted. And the cuffs, you can see where that the fabric is worn. And I hate to even confess this to you, but where some of it was a little white, I even took a little marker and just kind of colored it in so it would be black. That's how vain I am. But I love that old suit. But do you know what would be foolish? For me to take that suit and put a brand new piece of fabric in that suit, because if it ever began to have any type of agitation, you know what's going to happen? The stitching is going to rip the old and it'll be useless. So I'm just milking it as long as I can. You say, why don't you buy another suit? I've bought 3 or 4. They just don't fit as good as that one. And so I have 2 that I really like, and sometimes I'll throw in the other ones just for the fun of it. You know, and I have people comment, oh, that is a good looking suit. And I'm thinking, but it don't feel as good as them other ones. I like that old. I'll get to that in a minute too. And so you've got this garment, and Jesus is saying, you've got this old garment, it's comfortable. But you know that it has already shrunk. But if you put a new piece of garment and then you wash it, that new piece is going to begin to shrink and it's going to pull the stitching apart. And before long, if the sewing threads hold, then it's going to rip the old fabric. And so they can see that. So what is he saying? He's giving them a bridegroom and a wedding to think about. He's giving them a garment to think about. But now he's giving them a third thing to think about. I want you to look at verse 37. And no man putteth new wine in old bottles, else the new wine will burst the bottles and be spilled, and the bottles shall perish. Now, I hope that you're enough of a Bible student to know that that's not a Coca-Cola bottle. It is not a glass bottle. It is a skin bottle. Most of the time when they would have a bottle that they would put their grape juice in, it was usually a goat skin. Sometimes it would be a sheepskin, but usually it was a goat skin because the elasticity in that really, really was good. And so what they would do is they would have a new skin that had been sewn up tight so that it would not leak. They would do their best to try to keep the whole hide of an animal. They didn't just cut out little, they weren't making canteens. They're making whatever size the goat was, or the sheep, if they happened to use that skin, whatever size that was, they wanted to try to get as much out of it as they could. And they would begin to pour that into the new skin, so you had new juice, new skin. Now, what happens to new juice if you leave it alone long enough? It begins to ferment. I had an uncle that used to love to make his own wine. I never tasted any of it, but I could bet that my Uncle Herman, he was going to make some wine himself. And when I would go up to Bonaire, which is right outside of Warner Robins, I'd always go over to his house and we'd shoot pool together. And then I would walk outside on the patio where he had a nice garden in the backyard. And right down to my left, there would be an urn, and it had a cork in it, and it had a tube coming out of it, and that tube would go over into a little bit of water. It was put into the water, the end of the tube, so that no bug could get in and get into the juice that was fermenting. Well, if it were not for that tube that vented that juice, it would have just cracked that glass container all to pieces. Why? Because of the fermentation process and the release of gases. Now, I'm not going to get in tonight, but there's a whole deal about how wine was made in the Bible times. And when you read in Proverbs, it talks about that don't look on it when the wine's moving. Don't look on it when it's red. All of those things go into that winemaking process where that you would take it and it would be like one part of the fermented gel and it would be a multiple parts water and it would mix together. And so the alcohol content would be diffused. And so that was the part of the process. And so you would not take that new skin, an old skin, and put in new wine because the old skin had already stretched out. I mean, it was as far as it was going. And so if the fermentation began, it'd get tighter, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom. Sometimes when pressure gets on something, it explodes. A few years ago, we invited some people that we'd gone to college with to come to the house. One of those guys is a member of our church. He's in our Sunday school class, sings in the choir, Jeff Griffith. And so we had like eight of us sitting around the table, and I was sitting on the end. I think Deb might have been on the other end talking to some of the ladies. And to the right was a guy that was a retired state patrolman now, but back then he was still active. And he really, be honest with you, he wasn't paying attention to what was going on. He was focused on a salad dressing bottle. It had a dent in it where something had pushed in. And so he's got this in his hand, just like I'm taking this bottle right here. He's doing this with that salad dressing bottle. And all of a sudden, he put so much pressure on that thing that the top of that thing blew off. Salad dressing went on the ceiling fan, but it also went on the lady that was across the table. Her name was Danya Jaquo. And I mean, she had white stuff. His wife, Valerie, is going like, oh, like I can't believe, he is so embarrassed me. That's been years ago. I was talking to Greg, 2 weeks ago. He had called me one night to ask how Deb was doing. And we were talking, and I said, you know, we need to have you guys come back over and have another meal with us, and we'll just kind of get caught up, and we'll invite the other guys to come as well that was there. He said, maybe I can do another salad dressing that night. He hadn't forgot it, and we hadn't forgot it. That pressure was so great. And that pressure would be the same thing, probably multiplied, with those old skins if you put new juice in them. And so Jesus gives them three parables. You've got the bridegroom, you've got the old garment with a new patch, and you've got the old wineskin with new juice. Now, what is the whole teaching that he is mentioning here? Well, to me, it's simply this. Jesus did not come to reform Judaism. That's the old. He did not come to add Christianity to Judaism. Does not mean that we reject the Old Testament. We love the Old Testament. That was the Bible Jesus used. But we don't build on Judaism, we build on Christ. We have what is called the New Testament. Do you know what the word testament means? It means covenant. We have the New Covenant. And so Jesus is saying, we don't take the new wine and put it in an old bottle. We don't take Christianity and stuff it into Judaism. That's what the Judaizers did in Galatians. You remember when you read the history of the early church in Acts, I mean from place to place to place, these people were following wherever Paul went. They were trying to cause him damage. And so you don't take the new piece of cloth, which is Christianity, and you don't put it in the old garment, Judaism. You don't take the sadness of Judaism where everybody failed and stuff Christianity in that religious system. It's all about the Lord. Now let me close with this. I want you to look at the last part of verse 39. The old is better. The old is better. Now, there are times that I believe that. I think that older generations, for the most part, are wiser than the younger generations. I think that the character of the older generations is better than the character of the new generations. Had a guy come over yesterday, and he and I were talking, and he told me, he said, you know, he said, I think I was born at the wrong time. And I said, why is that? He said, well, I had an uncle, and him and my aunt have been married over 50 years. I said, that's good. I said, you know what you can do? He said, what's that? I said, you can start a 50-year run. You just got to be committed. And he goes, well, we've been talking about that. I said, who's that? He said, my girlfriend. Evidently, they just live together. But he's talking about the commitment that the previous generation had, and I'm trying to witness to him and go, if you knew the Lord, you could do that same thing. And so you've got the old is better in a lot of ways, but not this way. The law was a schoolmaster that showed us that we were lost. Jesus died on the cross so that we could be saved and have his righteousness, not ours. There's an event that took place the day Jesus died, and that was the day that Judaism died. And I'm not trying to denigrate Judaism because I love the Jewish people. I absolutely love. We support 3 or 4 different Jewish missionaries that witness the Jews all the time. One event that happened on the cross when Jesus died, the veil was ripped in two. And when that veil was ripped in two, that gave anybody access to God. You didn't have to go through some human high priest. Jesus became our high priest, and now we have direct access. You don't have to get me to, give you permission or get God's permission and then me tell you, okay, it's okay now for you to talk to the Lord. You can talk to the Lord just like I can talk to the Lord. When that veil was rent, Judaism died. And so these people are saying the old is better. You know, when I read that, sometimes it's hard for older people to trust Christ. That's a rare thing. I've not done it in a while, but on a Sunday morning, sometimes you can do this, where that you would say, how many of you were saved before you were 20? 80%. How many of you saved before you were 30? You'd have another 2 or 3%. You get up into the 70s and above, sometimes even 60s and above, you might have 1 or 2% of the people that got saved at that age. The overwhelming majority when they were young. It seems as though that there's a hardness, like those old wine bags. Now, let me just throw this in. Those old wine bottles, they weren't just discarded. Whenever the final bit of the paste, the jelly, so to speak, was squeezed out, they were not tossed. They were used for water. Now, I don't want to make a huge theological statement about this, but one of the pictures of the Word of God in the Bible is water, the water of the Word. There's also the Holy Spirit. And so the Christian, we have the Spirit of God. It's the same Spirit of God that was in the Old Testament that's in the New. We have the Word of God. We still revere the old just as we love the new. But we don't take the new and force it into the old garment of the old or the old wineskin of the old. And we have fun with the bridegroom. And so we need to make sure that we understand that sometimes there's a slowness, especially in Judaism. John Phillips called it a pathetic slowness. A pathetic slowness. It is pathetic. I told you about Hani, the guy that was our guide. He said, when asked, are you saved? He said, I've always been saved. I'm a Jew. That's a sad thing to hear. It's a sad thing to hear. I hope that he will see the error of his ways, and he will be like some of the other guys, like Ariel, who was one of the first guides that I ever had in Israel. And he was a Christian, and his wife was a Christian. They had just gotten out of the IDF, and I'm telling you, the second time I went, I actually had his phone number, and I called him up and invited them to come out and have a meal with me that night, and paid for their meal at the hotel, And so it was just a good time. But sometimes people that are in Judaism, they're blinded. There is a pathetic slowness, to steal a phrase from John Phillips.